The title is Discerning God's Purposes. And just to give you a sense of where we're headed, should you want to come back again, Wednesday morning at 10:30 and Friday morning at 11:30, you're not going to have to listen to me. And so there's something to be thankful for right there. We're going to be involved in the creativity process. We're going to put people to work creating new possibilities for their own lives, whether they're singles or married, whoever you are. New possibilities, creating new possibilities in lifestyle, vocation, new approaches to family life, housing, and celebration. We're going to come up with a list of about 10 creativity alternatives and give you a chance to choose which one you want to do. And we'll spend all morning Wednesday in the creativity process and part of Friday. And then Friday we'll share, and then Saturday we come back, and I don't know what time we come back on Saturday.
10:45.
That's amazing. Somebody does. 10:45, and talk about celebrating God's wild hope, how to build bridges. Everything that we've done this week, all of the different courses and programs and things we've been doing in this track, how to build bridges back to where we live and struggle, our work, our home, our other environment, because so often we come to a place like this and we don't know quite how to take it home and how to fit it in. So
it's 10:30.
It's amazing how quick the board changes. I think you need to go electronic instead of the marker board. Okay. So that's what we're going to do. And for those of you that haven't had a chance to get up and get into the hikes, people were talking about hikes last night, and I thought, well, I'd get up early and go on a hike. So at 6:15 this morning, I took off down this road. Somebody said, go down that road, and you find a trail that takes you up, and I went up to Holden Lake. And I wanted to try to get a little hike before breakfast. Well, you can't leave at 6:15 and get to Holden Lake before breakfast, but I sure tried. And for those of you that are going tomorrow, how many are going to Holden tomorrow? Where are your waders with you? Because there's a stream that you have to ford there that is well over your ankles. Just so you are alerted to that, unless you're going to bring pontoons with you or something. I was within a half mile of the lake and I turned back because I decided I didn't want to wade it. So two and three quarters hours up and back. So enjoy that. We're going to be talking about discerning God's purposes tonight, and I'm going to be using the word kingdom, which I want to clarify in the original language does not have any kind of sexual connotation, you know, so we don't have to say queendom and kingdom. Just want to be clear there, okay? That in the original language, it's the sense of the reign of God, the realm of God, and I'll be using that language too, but just want to clarify in terms of sensitivity. Shifting lifestyle change in the future tense. We're talking about all kinds of things. First of all, how many of you were here the other night? Okay. The other night we talked about the future as anticipation and trying to anticipate the new challenges and the new changes that are coming down. And I just wondered if there's any question, feedback, or comment on that before we plunge into tonight. We didn't have as much time to talk as I wished, and I just wondered if there anything that kind of slopped over from that. Okay, well, you're easy. I just want to say, Holden is much more of a gift than I ever would have imagined. I have been reading about Holden for a long time, and I have a chance to travel around the country a good deal. I have not found any other place in the country like Holden. And I think, how many of you are on permanent staff here? I don't know if you realize how unique a place you guys have to hang out. This really is. There's no other place like this. And somehow I think you need to get the message out beyond the Lutheran Church. I know of so many people in Seattle that would be rampaging up here in a minute if they knew that this kind of program existed in this kind of setting with this kind of people and the teachers and everything from the wonderful jazz during dinner to throwing pots and climbing mountains and talking about ecology. There's so many people just in the Seattle area. So whoever's involved in marketing and promotion, I'd like to talk to you and make a personal commitment to do some recruiting and beat the bushes. And who's the person?
Right over there.
Okay. Get the word out. Are you
already turning people away?
Oh, you're already turning people away? Well, it's a slack week this week, so
I was. Yeah, early June is the only time.
Oh, okay. Well, then forget that. We'll just keep it for the loop. Okay. So much for that.
We expected another 175 singles, but they.
Okay, they didn't. Well, I can give you some clues there. Before we go forward into what we're going to talk about tonight, for those of you that weren't here, I want to give just a quick recap going back to the future. I want to go back to the other night, and just for those, how many weren't here the other night? Just give a sense. Quite a few. Well, what we did the other night was try to sketch, very broad brush, some of the global and national challenges that we're likely to face in the next 10 to 15 years as we cross the threshold into the 21st century. And my best read on that is that the challenges are going to escalate at really quite a remarkable rate in terms of the widening gap between rich and poor, the widening gap between olders and youngers in our society, the range of issues that the church is going to need to address as we cross the threshold in the 21st century is going to expand dramatically. Now the problem, and it is a serious problem that I'm finding in working with the church, and I work with a very broad spectrum of the church. I work with Catholic Marian fathers and brothers and sisters. I work with Catholic foreign mission boards. I work with ALC. I work with Missouri Synod leadership. I've worked with the Reformed Church in America. I also work with evangelicals and charismatics. The mainline churches are graying and declining at a very significant clip. I've talked to leadership in many denominations, and the leadership, who are also near retirement, don't seem to be concerned. I say, hey, look at what's happening. You're losing your young people. Your budgets are going to be in trouble in the next few years. Your numbers are going down. And they say, hey, you know, it's like getting older. It happens. But it isn't inevitable in terms of the church. Of course, for us individually, it is. The crisis, and I think we're facing a crisis, is the needs for peace and justice are going to be escalating, and the people that care about peace and justice are going to be disappearing. And that just doesn't work real well. And the problem is, frankly, you guys aren't keeping your own young people. You are doing a poor job of retaining your young people than any other of the church constituencies, the Catholic or the evangelical. You're not losing them to conservative Protestantism. You're losing them to full-blown secularism. So I'm trying to raise an alert, because the growing edge of the church in numbers are your more conservative, independent, fundamentalist churches. They're not going to pick up the cause for justice and peace issues. Their agendas don't have much to do with the poor and the homeless. So that's a backdrop for what we're going to do tonight. You kind of have a flavor of what we talked about the other night. I'm just very concerned. I'm really quite alarmed, because you need to read books like Mainline Religion by Ruffin McKinney, which is a book that puts that in perspective. I failed to put it on the bibliography. I'll write it in a minute. So we were also talking the other night about people living at threshold time. We're living at the threshold of the last decade of the 20th century. We're living at the threshold of the third millennium since the coming of Christ. Not only are we facing a world that's changing very rapidly, but the function in that world, we need to understand where we're coming from. So tonight we're going to talk about two things. We're going to talk about discerning God's purposes, and then we're going to talk about how we can take the imagery of the purposes of God and really start to find a different premise for life. My basic contention is that one of the reasons you guys aren't keeping your young people in your mainline churches is that you've embraced modernization and the Western dream uncritically. And then being a Christian is something you do around the edges over the top. We simply aren't going to be able to address the challenges of the 21st century unless we fundamentally reconnect our lives with some sense of biblical purpose and vision. Not just doing the American dream with little Jesus overlay, but reconnecting with a different dream. So that's what we're going to get into tonight, and I'm going to try to suggest what that might look like in terms of some radically different approaches to discipleship and stewardship and celebration. I've worked with a lot of different groups. As I mentioned a moment ago, and I was speaking at my parents' church, which is an American Baptist church in Burlingame, California, in an adult forum with a room full of people about this size on the future of world hunger. And I was about 5 minutes into my presentation on the future of world hunger, and a woman sitting right over here gets up, walks out. Well, when you speak, you get used to people getting up and walking out. I didn't think that much about it. But 10 minutes before I was done speaking about the future of world hunger, that same woman came back in and sat right back down. My curiosity got the best of me. I grabbed her arm on the way out, and I said, I beg your pardon. I've had folks walk out on me before, not unusual, but I've never had anybody come back. Can you explain that? Oh, she said, it isn't hard to explain. She said, you were talking about kwashiorkor and malnutrition and the faces of hunger and the escalating need. She said, it was so compelling and so motivating. She said, all of a sudden, I realized I hadn't had breakfast, so I went out and got breakfast and came back. True story. So whatever kind of response you're motivated tonight, we'll just be appreciative. Really happy.
Excuse me, Tom. This isn't about people walking out, but there are a dozen chairs here and about a dozen people out there without chairs.
Please come in if you want to come in. If you'd rather stay in the other room, we've got chairs. Please join us if you'd like. If you'd rather sit in the overflow, that's fine.
This is the equivalent of the balcony in the fire side.
I see. Okay. People want to keep distance. This way they don't have to get up and walk out. We just never even see them go. Okay. In terms of getting into this whole area, The reason I think the church is failing, and I think the church is failing to really motivate its people to begin to address the new needs and challenges, is a crisis of vision. I think the number one crisis in the church today, in fact, is a crisis of vision. Kenneth Boulding, many of you know his writings, said that no people, no society, no organization can long exist without some compelling image of the better future that calls us forward into tomorrow. The scripture says, without a vision, the people perish. But not only we are perishing, but the people we're called to minister to in Christ's name are perishing because we lack vision. Now, when I'm talking about vision, I'm not talking about anything hyper-spiritual. I'm simply talking about the imagery of the better future. The imagery of the better future that we want for ourselves, for our loved ones, and for the larger, you know, for the people with whom we share this world. Okay? The imagery of the better future. There is very little critique within the church of the kinds of imagery that we work with culturally. My doctorate is in American intellectual history, and so I'm working out of that orb, and then I want to come back and do some theological work with you. And many of you have more theological background than I, so we can have some good discussion. But the implication for this crisis of vision that is in our individual lives, singles, couples, marrieds, I find people I work with in church across the country have absolutely no sense of direction in their life. They know they're called to follow God, but they have no idea what that means. They don't know what it means in terms of vocation. They don't know what it means in terms of their discretionary time, overall direction of life. And so they kind of wind up just going with the flow of the culture and trying to show up at church on Sundays. They really don't have any larger sense of intention because the church, for all the theologies of the kingdom that have been written, the church has not brought into the popular consciousness of people anything that's biblical. So I run into people, college people, older people who have no sense of direction. It's widespread. In the churches, we're afflicted with what I call chronic randomness. You've got the men's group going this way and the women's group going this way and the young people going this year way. And once a year, you have a potluck to celebrate the fact that you're still doing some of the stuff this year you did the year before. Nobody knows how it all comes together. There is no overarching vision that integrates and provides focus. Our churches lack direction and vocation. Our lives lack direction and vocation because we have not worked compellingly from scriptural material to discover the dream of God that can provide the direction for our lives. Now, there are no shortage of non-biblical visions in our world. From Marxism to capitalism, you can find them. And the number one dream is the American dream, the Western dream. Now, the storytellers of the Enlightenment, I'm popularizing a little bit, told us a new story. It goes something like this. If we cooperate with natural law, they have told us that all of society is going to progress economically and technologically. They've taken the vertical quest for God and God's kingdom that was the center point of society through the Middle Ages and tilted it on its side so it became the secular pursuit of progress. And the imagery of the better future, the Western dream, the American dream, sees the better future almost entirely in economic and materialistic terms. Now, someone has written that Marxism says all there is matter. Capitalism says all that matters is matter. But they're both inherently materialistic dreams lacking any sense of transcendence. It's just how high you can stack it and how much you can accumulate. And so what's happened then is that we have come to understand the better life for ourselves and the people we care about in economic terms. We all want what's best for our kids. No one can fault that, but Christians and non-Christians alike see wanting what's best for our kids in largely economic terms. As young people coming out of Christian homes get started in life, where do they head? They head for the burbs, and they head for the most expensive suburban community they can afford, wanting what's best for their kids, seeing what's best in largely economic terms. And you know what I'm talking about. Every Christmas looks like the department store blew up in the living room. You know what I'm talking about? Where the whole of society is, the whole sense of what is important gets tied up in that. And the values that go with the American dream are values that are inherently in tension with the values of the kingdom. They're values of materialism and self-seeking and consumerism and individualism, profoundly in contradiction. And what we've done is people in the church, mainline, evangelical, whatever your origin is to take all of that baggage and that vision of the better future and claim it as ours, and then following Jesus and following Christ and being faithful is something we try to do around the edges. Well, the problem, and this is a serious problem in terms of what I talked about the other night, is that while many of you who are older were able to buy the split level and everything that went with the American dream on a single income, single job, young people today, it takes them at least two incomes, and some of them will never own a house. But they're going to spend the next 30 years of their life trying to do and have everything that mom and dad did, because for all of the talk about faithfulness and justice and peace, the message we've given the young people is that what's important is getting our career underway is number one. Agenda number one is getting our house in the burbs. Agenda number one is getting our upscale lifestyle started. And then with whatever is left over of time and resources, we try to follow Christ and serve on committees for justice and peace. Can't get there from here. And the problem is that the young people who have bought that dream, because we sold it to them in Christian homes and churches, are not going to be available in the future because they will not have the discretionary time or money left over. The Women's Volunteer Corps is out the window. That's already gone. Okay? Young people, young boomers, are already finding they have much less discretionary income than people of my generation. And the young baby bust generation, people under 25, they're just going to have a dickens of a time trying to buy that house and everything that goes with it, unless we can help them find another dream. So what I want to say first of all, and I'd be glad to do battle with any of you on this, that the American dream is not the biblical dream. The rat race is not the good life. It's a fraud. 86% of us are chronically stressed out. 68% are chronically stressed out, according to Lou Harris, and doing nothing about it. Why are we stressed out? Because we're trying to do it all and have it all, and we're trying to get our piece of this dream. There's a little children's book called Hope for the Flowers. Have you seen Hope for the Flowers? And it's all about Stripe. And Stripe is going through the meadow, a happy little caterpillar, just going through the meadow, merrily on his way. All of a sudden, Stripe comes upon this humongous mountain of caterpillars, all climbing over one another, way up into the clouds and beyond, driven by a single obsession to know what's at the top. And climber be climb, they had to know what's at the top. Well, Stripe watches for a while and gets caught up in the same contagion. And as the story comes to an end, Stripe, at tremendous cost to himself and the other caterpillars, finally makes it to the top of this huge caterpillar mountain, only to find out there's nothing there at all. How many of us in the Church of Jesus Christ, Lutheran, Baptist, Methodist, have been climbing that mountain and have been programming and encouraging our kids to climb that mountain when there may not be anything there at all? So what I want to suggest tonight is that there is another dream that we need to get connected to, because this isn't it. And you see, there's a mainline variation. And the mainline folks, we in the mainline churches buy into the American dream, but we're concerned about the poor. So our answer is not to question the dream or the values or the direction of that dream. There's no critique there. Niebuhr's Christ and Culture did a little bit. Bella gets after autonomy. But fundamentally, there's no critique of the dream. So our answer is to build an escalator into the dream to try to help the poor get a little taste of it too, okay? Not to critique it and not to fundamentally re-examine it. Evangelicals, how many of you are from more evangelical background? Those of you from evangelical background, we from evangelical background, I claim both mainline evangelical, are really schizophrenic. We believe that God is here to help us get our piece of the rock now until we get our souls raptured for the clouds. And the dominant evangelical image of the future of God, it has to do with clouds. I was at Wheaton College speaking to young people, and I said, what comes to mind, what imagery comes to mind when you think of the future of God? And they said, well, heaven. I said, well, fine. What imagery comes to mind when you think of heaven? They said, clouds and harps and angels' wings. Clouds and harps and Plato has had his way with our mind. It was Plato who wrote that little ballad, this world is not my home, I'm just a passing through. It was the Greeks that said this created world is nasty stuff that we want to escape from. We want to escape from the body. The affirmation in Lutheran worship every week about the resurrection of the body is not understood, that we're going to be resurrected as whole people, mind, body, soul, and spirit, to be a part of a new heaven and new earth. And so the consequences for the future, if we continue to sell our young people the wrong dream and live it out ourselves, we're not going to be present with our lives or resources to work for justice and peace. The average giving in the church today is 2.8%. In most of your mainline churches, it's significantly less than that. The people that talk most about peace and justice and concern for the poor give the least. And so it's time for us to fundamentally reevaluate what we're here for. Retired people, single people, couples, and fundamentally go back. I think we need to go back to Scripture. We're going to do a little biblical work, and if there was time, I would try to get us to do an inductive study through Isaiah. But we're just going to be real quick tonight because I want to break us down into groups and talk about it. What was ruptured by the fall? Let's do a little biblical work here. This is proper at Holden, isn't it? Can't you ask questions like that? What was ruptured by the fall in Genesis? Help me out a little bit.
The relationship between people and God.
Our relationship to God. What else?
Relationship between people and the earth.
Relationship to the creation of God. What else? Relationship to one another.
With each other.
One another. And a theologian working in India says that, Christopher Wright says that God's redemptive solution has to be as big as the problem. God certainly wants to reconcile us to himself, and evangelicals are very clear about that. But evangelicals don't recognize that God also wants to reconcile us to one another. That's why we're work for justice and peace and to God's good creation. So God's agenda, God's redemptive agenda, is a very broad agenda. If we had time, we would do some work through Isaiah. These are just a selection of a part of the vision. If you want to write these down and study them later, I would recommend that. Let me just try to sketch for you. The imagery of the future of God is not in the clouds. It involves the imagery of a new heaven and new earth. Isaiah 65, 17 to 19 talks about an imagery of a new heaven and new earth. Revelation talks about a new heaven and new earth. Jerusalem coming down. So the imagery has to do not with the destruction of creation, but the completion of creation. So if we can be clear about that, first of all. But we're not only seeing the imagery of a new heaven and new earth, but the imagery throughout the prophets and the Psalms is of a new mountain and a new city. And it's the imagery of a migration. Can I sketch for you? Can you use your imagination a little bit? I can see more in my head than I'm able to communicate. So please bear with me and try to imagine with me for a few minutes, because we desperately need the imagery. We need to be captured by it. We need to get the theologians that understand about the reign of God together with the musicians and the artists and the dramatists to bring it into contemporary forms, to express it through the arts. Everything on this whole question tends to be very left brain. We need the right brain so that it really becomes the compelling part of our life, so that when we wake up in the morning, we wake up with the imagery of the future of God and what God intends for the future. And God's intention is not the American dream with church on Sunday. It's something very different. Come with me into a wasteland, a desert. One of the images of the prophets is the imagery of barrenness. As far as the eye can see, not a single blade of living grass. Can you picture that? A barren wasteland. Rising up out of that, Isaiah 2, 1 to 4, is a mountain that transcends all other mountains. Now look to the horizons. As far as the eye can see, look to the horizons. You see the small dots? Watch the small dots as they get closer. We see their people. They're people from every tongue, every tribe, every nation. As they start up that mountain, something remarkable happens. The blind really see. The deaf hear. And the lame run to the top of that mountain. At the top of that mountain, there's a new city. That city is homecoming. That city is peace. That city is justice. And God is in the midst of that city, wiping away all tears from our eyes. Okay? The imagery of the intentions of God throughout the Old Testament hasn't just to do with the spiritual realm or things liturgical. It has to do with a world made completely new, a new heaven and new earth where everything is restored. Read Isaiah 35, 1 to 10. Tremendous imagery of the restoration of creation, where the blind see and the deaf hear, all things restored. Read Isaiah 25, 6 to 9. The imagery of the banquet feast, of the people coming to this huge banquet on the mountain of God, the city of God, and the poor are going to be the ones that are served the seats of honor at that table. Okay? The imagery is imagery of celebration and restoration and wholeness and healing. And if we're to understand who we're called to be as the people of God, we need to be captured by the imagery of all that God purposes. God's purposes for the human future, for the creation. God purposes a new age of righteousness in which there's no more sin, personal or structural. But also, God also purposes a new age of justice in which there is no more oppression of the poor. God also purposes a new age of peace, where the instruments of warfare are made into the implements of peace. God also purposes a new kingdom of celebration, of banqueting and partying, and a little bit like the balloons last night, where we start to cut loose a little bit. God also purposes the restoration of the whole created order. God also purposes that the blind see and the deaf hear, and when we will be redeemed, we will be restored and made whole. The purposes of God throughout the Old Testament, the imagery is breathtaking. Now, if we're to understand who the Messiah Jesus is, we can only understand who the Messiah is against that backdrop. Jesus Christ is not just the full disclosure of God. Most certainly, he is that. Jesus Christ, the one that we call Lord, is the very future of God. Do you want to see the future of God? Look at Christ go down the road and touch that man that has never walked on those legs since the day he was born. Look at him get up and run down the street praising God. There's the future. Look at him open the eyes of the blind. There's the future. Feed the hungry. set free the possessed, hug the kids, forgive the sinner. In the life and ministry of a servant Jesus, we are given a preview of coming attractions. If you want to see what the future of God is like, study the Gospels. As we see Christ walking through the dusty back roads of Palestine, we're given a glimpse of all that God purposes. Okay? And if we want to understand who we are to be in terms of this God and in terms of this Christ, then we need to pay attention to Christ as he stands up in his hometown at the beginning of his ministry. What does he read from as he stands up Nazareth at the beginning of his ministry? What does he read from?
Isaiah.
Isaiah 61. And he reads, sight to the blind, release to the captives, good news to the poor. And then he says something quite remarkable. Today has this scripture been fulfilled in your hearing. Okay? Now what did that mean? Against the backdrop of the purposes of God, righteousness, justice, peace, reconciliation, wholeness, and love, what did that mean? What did he mean when he said, today has this scripture been fulfilled in your hearing? What did that mean?
In him was the fulfillment.
And what it meant for him to be the Messiah of God was to commit his life to work for the purposes of God. No more complicated than that. For him to be the Messiah of God was to commit his life to working for the purposes of God. Sight to the blind, release to the captives, and good news to the poor. Now that's what it meant. Now, a few chapters later, John sends his disciples to find out if Jesus is the Messiah or not. And so he sends his disciples to find out. And what does Christ tell John's disciples? Go tell John what?
What you have seen.
What you have seen. And which is?
Healing.
The blind see. The deaf hear. The dead are raised from the poor. Yeah, and blessed is the one who hasn't offended me. The proof of his messiahship was the fact that he was working for the purposes of God. It was really happening. Now, the next step, and this is where we become involved, is that what it meant to be a follower of this Christ in the first century was exactly the same. There was no way in century one we could claim to be followers of this Christ if we weren't working for the purposes of God. It wasn't possible. That's why people did really outrageous things. They quit jobs and left homes because to be a follower of this Christ meant that we were to have our life directions fundamentally altered. That's not what's taught in our churches today. Mainline churches, you go through your confirmation. Evangelical churches, you go through your conversion. In both cases, it's pretty much carry on with the cultural agenda and then do some religious practices along the side. That's not what was happening in century one. Century one, people were reordering their lives because they had a new purpose. To be a follower of this Christ meant everyone was involved in ministry for the kingdom. It didn't mean that everyone was doing it every waking minute. But you can be a spiritual leader, you can be a member of the synod in any church in this country and never, ever leave the building to be actively involved in witness or service to anybody else. Not expected. But that wasn't possible in the first century because they were working for a new vision. Now, can you see the contrast between the American dream that sees the better future primarily in terms of acquisition, accumulation, how much we can store in garages and ring up on our IRAs and getting the boat, getting the second home? Can you contrast that with the vision of a God at work in history, making all things new, sight to the blind, release to the captives, where the focus is on the other, the focus is on restoration and not accumulation? Can you see the contrast? Can you see the difference? Can you see where we've all been co-opted and sold a bill of goods? God calls us to a way of life that's more festive. It is more celebrative than anything the rat race can offer. But it involves putting first things first. And so the implications for our lives as singles and marrieds, retired and those who are starting their careers, starting their lives, is that the number one decision in our lives is not where we're going to live, where we're going to work, who we're going to marry. The number one decision is what are God's purposes and how am I to be connected? How am I to be actively involved every week? Whether it's an evening a week working with abused kids, whether it's taking a full-time job working in a Lutheran congregation, whether it's going overseas, every person involved. You see what we have today in terms of the escalating challenges we talked about the other night? 75% of the people are in the bleachers sitting on their hands because we've taught a kind of discipleship that involves no sense of responsibility outside the doors. And mainline people have forums on justice and peace issues and they have all these wonderful teaching times and discussions, but it never seems to break them out of the building. Then they will give to a city council of churches to go out and do a little bit, and they don't give very much. All of your councils are not giving very much, so they have kind of surrogate servanthood where we pay people to go out and work with the poor. It's unusual to find mainline churches where the people are hands-on involved working with the homeless. Generally, you're paying somebody downtown to do it for you. So the implications are that for us to be followers of this Christ means that we need to find a new vision, a biblical vision around which we surround our lives, and that every one of us needs to find some way to be involved actively every week, one evening a week, 10 hours a week, and working for that. The implications for the church are the same. Most of our congregations, if we were to do an audit before the time and money goes, it stays right at home. Bonhoeffer, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, said, unless we're the church for others, we're not the church at all. Well, if we did any kind of a fair assessment of the church in the United States and North America, we are not the church for others. We are basically the church for ourselves. Most of the money stays right in the building and the time. We can't begin to address the urgent issues that we're talking about here in this setting unless we start to get back in touch with a new vision. Well, what does that look like then in terms of seeking first the purposes of God? What I talk in terms of creating whole life discipleship and whole life stewardship. And the reason I use the term whole life is because what I want to challenge that prior assumption that seems to be there that we've got to do the whole cultural agenda as a foregone conclusion. All that's expected in terms of career and house and acquisition, and then our Christian stuff is something we do after the fact. I want to put it just the opposite. I want to suggest that whole life stewardship, whole life discipleship begins with putting God's purpose at the center of our hearts and lives, and then moves us into a very different approach to how we steward our time and resources. Now, this little diagram is designed for college people, more of evangelical background, but I think Link might help us. He's in my book, Why Settle for More and Miss the Best. And the popular evangelical understanding, and I think this will translate for Lutherans and mainline people too, being a Christian is God coming in and transforming people's heart, healing their psychological hang-ups, but leaving their life directions and life values absolutely untouched. What were their life directions before they became Christians? Upward mobility. What was their life direction after they became Christians? Exactly the same. Nothing changed, except we felt God was there to kind of help us up the hill a little quicker, okay? What were our life values before we became Christians? Materialism, individualism, seeking life, the values of the culture. Afterwards, exactly the same. Again, nothing changed. Because we've talked about our spirituality and spiritual formation primarily in terms of a small spiritual compartment of our life. In evangelical churches, we talk about God helping us in our relationships and dispositions and those kinds of areas. In mainline churches, you talk about struggling with the structures. But nobody's talking about inviting God to transform the fundamental life direction and life values. And in the first century, I think there was something very different going on. In this model, people don't have time to be involved. Increasingly, young don't have time to be involved because trying to do it all and have it all leaves very little left over to respond to the tremendous escalating challenges that we're going to see in the next few years. In century one, I don't think the people were doing Roman culture 9 to 5 with a house church on the weekend. Okay? I think they understood following God was a whole life proposition. So what I'm suggesting is that I think the kind of conversion, the kind of commitment that we see in century one, certainly is inviting God to transform our heart, but also transform our life direction from upwardly mobile lives to outwardly ministering lives. Every Christian in ministry and service. Every Christian. That's what I see in the first century. And transforming our life values from lives centered in materialism to lives centered in spirituality and the celebration of relationships. Have any of you traveled in the third world? Have you seen some people there? I find my friends in the third world are having a lot better time than most of my friends in the United States. Because they understand that the good life doesn't have to do with how high you can stack it and the accumulation of things. It's in the celebration of relationships. We need to go back to the Bible and fundamentally redefine what the good life is. It has nothing to do with how much we can accumulate or how much we can invest. It has to do with fundamentally redefining what the good life is. Instead of life-centered and individualism, and the autonomy in our churches is rife. I mean, any of our churches, autonomy is rife. Very seldom do you find the kind of koinonia and community that is growing here in Holden. Community is the norm. To be in communities where we actually relinquish personal autonomy. Can I give you an example? I was mentioning this to Luann that I was talking to. The president of the Mennonite Seminary in Elkhart is a part of a Mennonite church, and they're in small group structures. I think each one of us needs to be in some kind of a small group structure where we're known, loved, held accountable. Held accountable there is taken very seriously. These Mennonites not only hold one accountable every week, but twice a year they bring their budgets and their time schedules. And they share everything that they've been doing with their budgets and their time schedules and ask for discernment in the body, in that small group. before they make any purchases, CDs or second homes. They bring it to the reference of that group. That kind of community is much more like we read about in the first century, and the kind of autonomy that Bella writes about in Habits of the Heart is so much a part. God wants to change that. And instead of seeking life, discovering that Christ was right after all, the good life is to be found in the life given away. And we not only need to talk about that and do liturgies around it, we need to have families that represent that. We need some whole new approaches to what that looks like. And what this does then is to move us in a whole different approach to stewardship, not only whole life discipleship, but whole life stewardship. What do houses cost where you come from? What does your basic three-bedroom house cost where you come from? Could we have some prices here, right?
$300,000.
$300,000. You're from Southern California?
No.
San Francisco.
San Francisco. I'm from San Francisco. $300,000, which is close. It's over $1 million in 30 years if you buy a house there. Where else?
$70,000.
You're close to a third of $1 million. Seattle, you can still get a house kind of for $100,000. Which is really $500,000 over 30 years. Well, where this leads me in terms of a different approach to stewardship is that I don't think the tithe view of stewardship has anything to do with what's going on in the New Testament. Understanding the Old Testament origins of the tithe, a growing number of New Testament scholars are telling us there's no supportive evidence for a tithe view of stewardship in the New Testament. What seems to be going on, rather, is whole life or jubilary stewardship that we talked about the other night. Whole life stewardship based on the premise the earth is the Lord's. No longer a question of how much of mine do I have to give up, question of how much of God's do I get to keep in a world in which there's not enough to go around. Peter and Andrew didn't even sell the fishing business, walked away from it. Do you remember Zacchaeus? Half to the poor, four times anyone he cheated. That wasn't 10%. You remember the rich young ruler? That was not a quiz. That was a real test, okay? The following of Christ in century one was a whole life proposition. Now, not everybody followed the model of the Jerusalem church and gave everything away. But they understood that following Christ was a whole life proposition. And we're not even giving 10%. We're just giving out of our leftovers today. The kind of stewardship we find in the New Testament moves us in another direction. Not out of guilt, but out of opportunity, we have the chance to steward our whole lives to see how much of our time and money can really be freed up for the purposes of God. Sight to the blind, release to the captives, good news to the poor. This gets into housing. The young people are starting out to try to buy that $100,000 house that really cost $500,000. That's for the next 30 years, talk about the Lordship of Christ. For the next 30 years, they're working for a mortgage company, okay? We're serious here. So we need to help people find another way. John and Pam found another way. Out of their discipleship, they found a different way to house themselves. They're in Redmond, Washington. They asked the question, how much floor space do we really need? In a world in which Christians cannot shelter their kids, do we really need houses large enough to have roller skating parties in on the weekend? One of the areas that we've indulged ourselves in these lavish homes, when there are other people in the world and other Christians in the world, they can't shelter the kids. They decided not. All they needed with two little boys was a two-bedroom house. They've just finished construction of a two-bedroom house in Redmond, Washington, split level. It doesn't have the big two-car garage or the big rec room, but it has two bedrooms and a bath upstairs, gabled ceiling, living room, dining room, kitchen combination, the most beautiful cabinetry work I've ever seen in any home. Super insulated house, total price, $25,000 front-end cash. Now, what's the difference between $25,000 front-end cash and a $100,000 house that cost $500,000 over 30 years? What's the difference? It's a whole lot of two people's life is the difference. Whole life stewardship is what the small business owner does. The small business owner orchestrates their whole business to maximize bottom line, which is profit. We need to be just as creative to orchestrate our whole life, not at 10%, but how can we alter our whole life, reducing what we need for ourselves, so that we have more to share with someone else. Do you see the possibilities of whole life stewardship? In terms of the challenges that we talked about Sunday night, the amount of resource of time and money that could be freed up for the kingdom is incredible if we start to think as they did in century one in terms of whole life stewardship. Well, where does this lead us in terms of single people and married people, retiring people and others? The implications for all of our lives, is that we all need to be involved in finding how to put God's purposes first. Now, some of us can work for the purposes of God through a job. I have a friend who felt God called him into engineering. He graduated from the University of Washington, was offered a very high-paying job for Boeing making cruise missiles. For him, that was counter-kingdom. He turned it down. Pay was great. Bennies and perks were wonderful. He turned it down. Took a job redesigning cardiology equipment. A little later, after he worked there for a while, somebody invited him to a home for cerebral palsy kids, an Easter Seal home. So he went, you know. And in that home and in that visit, it all came together for Al. He's now just finished his doctorate at the University of Chicago, learning to use advanced engineering design and computer systems to help cerebral palsy kids move for the kingdom of God. Do you see the possibilities? What we haven't done with our young people in any of our churches is help them to think creatively about the training they've had in business, law, engineering. Any business training can, with a little imagination, have a specific kingdom application. You can be working in law for reconciliation through Victor Offender Reconciliation Program. In business, we need people to start small businesses in the inner city. There's a program Tony Campola started, Eastern Baptist. Get MBAs to help people start small businesses among the poor in the United States and overseas. There isn't any kind of training that we've had that cannot have a kingdom focus. Now, I'm not saying it has to have, but if we cannot find a way through our work hours to specifically be working for God's purposes, then we need to change our time styles and find at least one evening a week to work with those abused kids, to really be working on a project that works towards peace and justice, to be working for awareness regarding the environment. We simply cannot get the job done with just paid clergy and a few full-time people out there beating the bushes. The only way we can begin to respond is for all people, singles and families, to do it. Now, singles, those of us who are single, we have more time. We don't always have more resources, but we have more time. So maybe our answer is finding one evening a week to work with those kids or work with... I'll tell you the way some singles did it, moving to Oakland, California. Some people had just graduated from Westmont College, six of them. I call them Westmont Six. They moved to Oakland. Purpose of God that they felt called to work for was young people in the inner city who were poor and the whole situation there. Nobody would give them any money. They were right out of college. So they found by living together in shared housing, they could get by for $250 a month in Oakland, California for rent, food, and utilities. Then they didn't have to have a full-time job. Nothing in the Bible says you have to work at a 40-hour week job. They found that they could support themselves working 20 hours a week, and then they had 30 hours a week free to do ministry. They went to First Baptist Church in Oakland. They'd had a gym that's been closed up for years. They said, can we open the gym? Open the gym. They had 40 to 60 inner city kids in off the street immediately, and they have a half a dozen ministries made possible through whole life stewardship. A doctor in Denver did it a different way. He sold half of his medical practice. He found he could support his family very comfortably on 20 hours a week, given what American doctors are paid these days. So he supports his family 20 hours a week, but the other 20 hours a week he started an inner city health clinic. There's no right or wrong way, but the answer is to be a part of the kingdom, to be a part of the purposes of God, to be a part of this vision of restoration that floods through the Old and New Testament. All of us have to get involved, and showing up at church on Sunday and being on a committee isn't what it looks like. It's something much more. And for families, for all of the talk about family life, and there's so much in the church today, and evangelicals listen to Dobson and focus on the family, but in all honesty, what is it that bonds the American Christian family together? I mean, what do we do together more than anything else? It's exactly the same as the non-Christian family. The primary thing we do together is consume together. Sitcom, television, Big Mac, hamburgers, and trips to the mall. The primary activity that families do together that bonds them is consumerism. And I said in a Presbyterian church in Bellevue, Washington, I have never seen a church, and I can still say this, any place in the country, that facilitates families being bonded together in ministry to somebody else, where the kids are involved with mom and dad in ministry. I said, I've never seen that, where a church makes something in our mindset. We want to keep the kids back in the suburbs where we occasionally venture into the cities. Well, I went back to the church a few weeks later. The church hadn't changed, but this woman came up to me. She said, we are doing it. I said, what are you doing? She said, I'm going to work with senior citizens that are going to lose their homes unless somebody helps them with their chores, their bedfast. And unless somebody comes in and really helps them with their chores, they're going to lose their home. So I go in once a week to help them with their chores. I take my two little preschoolers with me. They don't just watch mom work. They're right down the floor, scrubbing the floor alongside me. Now, what kinds of kids would we raise up if we put the purposes of God at the center of family life? Where children for 18 years, instead of being indulged and inundated with all the things, for 18 years were involved with mom and dad in service and ministry to others. Sight to the blind, release to the captives, good news to the poor. It would revolutionize family life. Then we would probably start to see more kids hang around the church and not disappear when they get out of college. And it means creating communities for support and mission. The only way we can do this is in community. And spilling coffee on one another Sunday morning isn't community. We need the kind of community that the Shrams are in, where they're really starting to create community where there's that kind of accountability and support. In every church, we need small group structures to make that happen. And then we need to we need to look at the whole issue of housing. I want to come back to that for just a minute, because I think we need a new community movement. We haven't seen anything created new in terms of Christian community for 30 years. And during the Reagan years, and I don't want to blame Mr. Reagan for everything, but boy, there wasn't much social innovation going on during the Reagan years. We saw communities closing down. Reba Place, Sojourners, are you guys aware of these communities that are around the country? Well, there are a number of communities around the country. Virtually nothing has been born, and a lot of things have closed. Well, they're starting to see some new things born again. And let me just suggest what one of them might look like. A Mennonite pastor in Southern California is looking at planting a church in an area where housing costs $250,000, like San Francisco. And he realizes if he wants to have any young people, he's got to look at the housing issue. So he's looking at the possibility of buying enough land to not only build a church, but housing as well, sixplexes. And in Southern California, you can build sixplexes for $60,000 a unit, excluding land cost. And up here, you can do it for $40,000 a unit easy. Now, here's the model. The European co-housing model, Europeans have been doing it for years, not Christians. They just want to have community and support one another. Build a sixplex for $60,000 a unit in Southern California. 5-year no-interest loan. So instead of young people spending $1 million over 30 years for a $250,000 house, they pay $60,000 over 5 years for a $60,000 unit in a sixplex. Do you get the picture? Okay. Then write in the contract that a certain percentage of the money and time that's freed up, which would be significant, goes into Habitat for Humanity housing right in the same complex. So you get an immediate benefit for the poor, working for God's purposes. You still with me? Okay. And then before the six people move into the sixplex, the six couples, singles, marrieds, whoever they are, they write a covenant of how they're going to be the community of God together, how they're going to support one another, encourage one another, how they're going to parent their kids differently instead of just going with the flow where they, you know, everybody's got to dress alike and look alike and hit the ski slopes on the same weekend. That tremendous peer pressure is relentless unless you have a community that's going in a different direction. How can they celebrate life differently? You see, I think we can help our young people discover a new dream, the dream of the kingdom of God, discover a new way of life that's more festive and celebrated than anything the rat race can offer, and start from the ground up with housing, creating new communities, creating ways of life that are more festive and celebrated, answering the problems that both singles and couples are finding in terms of this whole issue of housing, and doing it in a way that forms new communities. And we need to create churches for others. We need to create churches where at least half their time and money gets out of the building. Churches need to do an audit every year of where their time and money is going. And we need to create celebrations. We started last night with balloons, and I think we can do better than James Bond and Trivial Pursuit. I think we can create our own good times, too. I think we can take charge of our lives. I think we can embrace the dream of God. I think we can allow it to capture our souls and spirit so that we can create ways of life that are more festive and celebrative. Friends and I have been doing Jewish celebrations for years. Now we start creating some of our own Christian good times, taking imagery from Scripture and creating our own celebrations. Nothing to stop us, okay? So we created the celebration called Advent 2 Homecoming. Advent 1, of course, when Christ came to us in Bethlehem. Advent 2 is when we come to the mountain of God, the city of God, the tremendous migration, okay? So we had a whole house full of people who didn't know each other. And the first thing we had the people do around this theme, Advent 2 Homecoming, was to share memories of homecoming. And one young man, I still remember, shared what it was like to come back alive from Vietnam when most of his friends did not come back alive from Vietnam. And a woman shared what she saw in her mom's eyes when she came home to welcome, okay? And people were very vulnerable. And then we read out of Isaiah about the captives coming home from Babylon, from the captivity to the city of David. And it started to get a little upbeat. And I said, now, let's sing the songs of Zion like we're coming home, like we're on that journey from Babylon to the city of David. And so people started singing, and you could feel the spirit start to rise. And I said, now let's dance in the streets of Jerusalem. Terror in the eyes of these Presbyterians. People who had never moved their bodies in their entire life, they started edging towards the door. And we had the door locked and bolted. We had a Jewish folk dance instructor there. We hit on the music, and for the first 15 minutes, it was painful to watch those poor Presbyterians try to move their bodies. I mean, it was painful. But after 15 minutes, they started to dance, they started to dance into the homecoming of God. They started to dance in the city of David with all of the celebration and festivity of what it will mean to come home to the future of God. They really got caught up in it. They really danced as though they were exhausted. And then we had a buffet with dishes from all over the world, because this wonderful homecoming of God is going to be an incredible cross-cultural event. So we had dishes from Africa and Asia and Latin America. We ate until we were stuffed. Then we ended the evening as we'll begin the homecoming with the bread and the wine of the Eucharist. We can take charge of our lives. We can create a better way of life. But it starts with a new dream. No longer can we do the American dream with a little religion worked in around the edges. We need to be fundamentally transformed and embrace the dream of a new heaven and new earth. of a world restored at the center of our lives, and then let the magic and the celebration, the creativity of that spill out into every one of us getting involved in ministry, alternative housing, celebrations, I think we would be absolutely amazed at what God would do through our mustard seeds to be a part in some fairly unusual ways of what God is doing to change the world. We live in an exciting time. We live in an overwhelming time, a time for us to be a part of all that God calls us to. Let's break up into groups of two or three and talk about it. And in this time of discussion, I want you to talk about ideas that you might have of specific things you could do to be a part of the inbreaking of something new. Find two other people. Let's talk for a few minutes. Lester Brown, you've got here. You know about Lester Brown. You know the City of Joy. If you can't afford a trip to the third world, the City of Joy will get you there. It's not an easy book, but it's a true book. It's about people who live in Calcutta. It reads like a novel, but it's all true. Jonathan Kozol, Rachel's Children, gives you a very human perspective on homelessness. This is the best book on the future, right now, on the American context. Age Wave by Dykewald. It talks about the baby boomers, but demographically it talks about all of us. This is the most radical book on discipleship. How many have read The Upside Down Kingdom by Crable? One or two hands. Very important book in terms of what we've been talking about. Alternative Celebration Catalog, singles. Marriage, alternative ways, gift giving, ways for young people to get married without putting parents up for ransom, all kinds of ways to do this, okay? Richard Foster's Celebration of Discipline, if you aren't. All of this begins in the life of prayer and spirituality. And I still think that Foster's book is the best introductory book if you're not into spirituality and prayer. Stanley Hauerwas's The Peaceable Kingdom, I find the most compelling book on ethics. And so much of what's being talked about in Holden has ethical framework. He talks about ethics in the context of community. Doris Longacre's Living More for Less has been around for a while, still has creative ideas of ways to scale down. And again, lifestyle change for me is not primarily scaling down, but it's cultural transformation, creating lifestyles of greater festivity, but also greater simplicity. And then my books, two of them are in the bookstore, the other one I'm trying to finish, Mustard Seed Conspiracy. Why settle for more and miss the best? They have questions at the end so they can be used in group discussions in churches. Then some other things. Futurist Magazine is a good reference if you want to keep track of the future. Put you in touch with the literature. Sojourners, you know about. Newsletter, Evangelicals for Social Action. If you're interested in a biblical approach to public policy issues, I think they do the best. I'm biased. And then Ruffin McKinney's book, Mainline Religion, talks about the decline of the mainline church if you want that.